And welcome into the Doug Russell Podcast. It's the weekend edition of the show, October 9th, 2020. The Packers, of course, are on their bye week. They'll take on Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers a week from Sunday. That is, unless, of course, the NFL messes around with the schedule, which is possible, I suppose, in theory. Last night on Thursday Night Football, the Bucs lost to the Bears in Chicago 20-19. Wild finish in that one. So the Bears are 4-1 on the season. And my rhetorical question to you is, has there ever been a worse 4-1 team in the history of football? As for last night's game, all I can say is that someone who's played in as many NFL games as Tom Brady has should probably know when it's fourth down, but that's neither here nor there. Some big games this weekend in college football. You've got number 21 Texas A&M playing host to fourth-ranked Florida. Also, it's number 19 Virginia Tech at number 8 North Carolina. Those are 11 o'clock kickoffs. The late afternoon kickoff, number 14 Tennessee taking on number 3 Georgia. And the late night game, not really the late night game, but the primetime game, if you will, top-ranked Clemson. They're playing host to number 7 Miami of Florida. Of course, no Big Ten teams, no Pac-12 teams are ranked yet because they haven't played yet. The Badgers open up in 2 weeks, October 24th, at home against Illinois. But there's not going to be a quarterback controversy after Jack Cohn injured his foot. He's out indefinitely. So that opens the doors up for maybe one of the most talked about recruits the Badgers football program has ever had in Graham Mertz. He sat out his true freshman year last season, but now he's the man, and he's been itching to play. This is now Graham Mertz's team. So, as he was sitting on the bench, as he was going through some reps, but not first team reps in practice, but in all of the quarterbacks meetings, all of the offensive meetings, what does he feel like he's improved on the most from last year?
Overall comfortability with the offense and really just owning that leadership role in the huddle and like really just know where I'm going with the ball whenever, like versus different coverages and all that stuff. So I think that just that's been the consistent growth for me. And now it's like it's at a place where I'm very confident where I'm going with the ball and how I'm doing that, how I'm throwing guys open.
But that's all in practice. Is he really ready for the starter's job?
The past 2 years, I guess. I feel like every day I've been trying to prep like I'm the starter. I think that's how it has to be for starters and backups. Like everybody's got to prep because you never know. And I think right now I'm very confident in my ability to win games here. And I think that practice has been going great in that sense. And I feel like we're ready to go.
Which is good because the Wisconsin program has never recruited better. And it's not just Mertz, but other blue chip recruits like Braylon Allen and Hunter Wohler, Loyal Crawford, just to name a few, all kids that are staying in state to play for Paul Christ. And there's one thing that I'll say definitely about Paul Christ is he has put up those walls on the state lines. If you are a top high school recruit in the state of Wisconsin, you're coming to Madison. That's it. There's no discussion about it. There have been blue chip guys that have gone elsewhere that are from the state of Wisconsin. Ben Bredesen comes to mind, going to the University of Michigan. I can't imagine that Ben Bredesen from Arrowhead High School, if he would have been maybe 3 or 4 years younger, I don't see any big name players from the state of Wisconsin not wanting to come to Madison with what they've built. Trey Wedding, another one from Kettle Moraine. He's staying in state after getting offers from literally everywhere. And then there's players that have relationships, like familial relationships, with some of the players that are already on the Wisconsin program, a kid like Nolan Rucci. Nolan Rucci, the name may sound familiar, but a five-star recruit from Pennsylvania. He's chosen Wisconsin over, again, literally everywhere. He had offers from Alabama, Clemson, LSU, Michigan, Notre Dame, Ohio State, Penn State, Stanford, all of these blue blood programs, and he's coming to Wisconsin. Now, you may recognize the name Rucci because he'll be joining his brother Hayden Rucci, a Badgers tight end, to protect Graham Mertz's blind side. Hayden will be, you know, playing tight end, and Nolan Rucci, the best left tackle prospect in the country, is coming to Madison to play for Wisconsin and, again, to protect Graham Mertz's blind side. So expectations, not just this year, but moving forward, are off the charts in Madison. As for Mertz,
I really don't look at it a ton. I mean, obviously people mention it to me and stuff like that. But for me, I just try to focus on what I can control. And that's like work ethic and just knowing like game week, you played football your whole life, like just go out and execute. I think the biggest thing for me right now is just execution and playing with that confidence that I had in high school. And I think that finally hitting that stride right now with the offense.
Again, the Badgers season opens up in just 2 weeks. We'll have a lot more on Wisconsin football coming up on Monday's show. Today, we've got a lot of baseball to talk about. Brewers GM David Stearns held a season-ending news conference earlier this week. There was some good, there was some bad, there was some ugly. The good, hey, they got to the playoffs for the third straight year. Yes, it was as the number 8 seed in a one-year expanded playoff experiment because of the COVID shutdown, but it's still the playoffs. That was the good. The bad, the hitting wasn't great. It was bad. The ugly was Christian Yelich's season. You love the guy. You love the fact that he wanted to stay in Milwaukee, signing that big contract extension in spring training before COVID hit. He was coming off back-to-back seasons where he was the National League's batting champion. He could have been the National League MVP, not only in 2018 when he did win it, but also in 2019. He was edged out by Cody Bellinger of the Dodgers. Of course, you remember Yelly had to miss the last 3 weeks of the season after fouling that freak injury where he fouled a ball off of his knee and he fractured his kneecap. Didn't require surgery, just required rest. Physically, he said he was feeling healthy when spring training rolled around. That having been said, at the time, it was like, great, Christian Yelich is going to stay in Milwaukee for the foreseeable future, signing a contract worth more than $200 million, which when you look at some of the crazy contracts that have been doled out in Major League Baseball over the last several years, whether it's Mike Trout, whether it's Manny Machado, some of the ones that have just broken the bank, you look at Yelly's contract of just over $200 million, and yes, that's a ton of money. It is generational wealth money. But he probably could have gotten more. If he were a free agent, he probably could have gotten more out on the open market. But he wanted to stay in Milwaukee. I still love the fact that Christian Yelich is going to be in Milwaukee. But he looked completely lost up there this year. He hit only 205 in 200 at-bats. You don't go from back-to-back batting titles to the Mendoza line very often. It was alarming. Hopefully, just a one-year aberration. But that was the hitting in 2020. Brewers GM David Stearns.
It's been unusual. It's been inelegant. And so wrestling through all of that and sort of tying a bow on top of it becomes a little bit more challenging than it would over the course of 162 games. And so that's part of the process that we have to go through as an organization is determine how best to really evaluate what was such a unique season. Clearly, from a performance standpoint, we had inconsistencies and we had areas of the roster where we underperformed, where the performance wasn't good enough for us to win consistently. And we need to address that. And we need to understand to the best we can why that is the case and do our best to do better going forward.
Like on offense?
It wasn't good enough. That's the reality. And we have to work backwards off of that. We begin with the premise that there is something in there that is explicable, that through our work and our research and our time, we can understand why. So that has to be the starting point.
Of course, there's a saying in baseball that hitting is contagious. So when your best player isn't hitting, it can affect everyone. That was Christian Yelich's season.
I think we're going to look back at a player who hadn't played competitive baseball for 10 months, who didn't then have a normal ramp up spring training time, who was then competing in an environment that was very different than he's ever competed in before. And we're going to remember that it was a shortened season where he never really had a chance to climb out of what was an early season slump.
I hope he's right. Certainly, Yelich got most of the attention this season, but catcher Omar Narvaez was awful at the plate in 2020 as well. That was unexpected.
The hitter that was in Seattle last year never got going. And so that was surprising for us. It was disappointing. We had been counting on him to be a stable part of our offense, and we just never got there. That's a big decision for us going forward. Is do we think that this was an anomalous season and that potentially he can bounce back next year?
As for Narvaez and the rest of the hitters, one element was because of COVID protocols in 2020. In-game adjustments, not necessarily as easy as they would be during a so-called normal year. Video wasn't available this year, for example.
Certain players rely on video a lot during the course of the game. Certain players don't go back there at all. There are absolutely players who, after every at-bat, go back, make sure that they're seeing the ball correctly, make sure that they're understanding the strike zone correctly, can quickly analyze their swing. And some players are very good at making in-game adjustments based on what they're seeing on video. So it really is specific player to player.
Particularly, though, for designated hitters, that video room is critical. They don't obviously have to go out into the field. They would either sit on the bench, go back to the batting cage, or go to the video room. But that brings up the question then, will the designated hitter be back for good in 2021?
I don't know the answer to that, and I would agree it's important to know. And I think it's just to know what type of roster you need to build. It would be helpful to know that as early as possible.
Fair enough. But what about other possible rule changes?
It seemed like, at least internally within baseball, the one that garnered the most widespread acceptance was the runner on second in the 10th inning. I know fan bases in general had a tough time with that one at the front end of the season. And I'd be curious what public perception of that rule is now. But I think within baseball, the runner on second rule garnered significant support throughout the year.
Changing gears, one area for the Brewers that did shine was the bullpen, especially guys where they didn't necessarily expect it from, like Eric Yardley, Drew Rasmussen, and Justin Topa.
Those three guys performed at pretty high levels. Yardley was with us all year and was one of the better relief pitchers in the National League this year. Topa came up, flashed really outstanding stuff to give us belief that he can play a role on our team next year. Rasmussen, for a rookie who really flew through a system, minor league system, didn't have AAA season, came up and got big outs for us, and we believe there's more from him as well. It's an important part of our team. We use our bullpens a lot. We count on them to get lots of outs for us, to get important outs for us, play lots of close games. And so having a good bullpen is important. I think our pitching coaches do a great job working with those guys. Craig manages our bullpen very well, and so that helps lead to success with that group.
One huge question, more for the individual than the team, is the question of Ryan Braun. His contract is up. He first hinted at retirement back at the On Deck event in January at the Wisconsin Center downtown. Kind of caught us all off guard. But then after COVID, he kind of hinted that he may not necessarily be all that keen still on retiring after a truncated season. So what does the GM see?
I think Ryan's going to take his time here. A constant with Ryan is I think he wants to understand what the world is going to look like as we get into next year. And we're not going to know that for a while. So I don't anticipate him really thinking much about this over the next couple months.
Finally, in professional sports, of course, it all comes down to money. And in 2020, there was a lot less of it to go around for all of us because of the pandemic, where no fans were allowed in ballparks. Large market teams like the Yankees and Dodgers can probably absorb that. Smaller market teams like the Brewers, they have a tougher time.
I think budgets are tighter everywhere for most businesses. You know, over the last 2 years, we've run the two highest payrolls in the history of this organization. And I think it's uncertain at this point, as we look forward, whether our payroll next year would be at that same level.
Brewers president of baseball operations, David Stearns, at his annual end of season news conference with reporters. Joining us now here on the Doug Russell Podcast, as we continue on, he's one of the contributing experts on Reviewing the Brew blog. That's part of the Fan-Sided Network. He's also the co-host of the Cold Brew Podcast. We welcome into the Doug Russell Podcast, Matt Carroll. Matt, I appreciate the time. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining me on the podcast. What was your takeaway from anything and everything that you heard from David Stearns earlier this week?
You know, I think he admitted to pretty much what Brewers fans saw. You know, he was open and honest about the fact that a lot of his acquisitions didn't quite hit. He touched on Ryan Braun, saying that he's going to give Braun some time to make his decision before kind of moving forward. And then he also touched on the payroll a little bit, discussing how it's a very likely scenario next year that they go into it at either even or a little bit lower of a payroll after, you know, obviously the COVID situation this year and being unsure of what that situation will be next year. So it wasn't terribly surprising. So now we go into the offseason kind of waiting to see what he's going to do.
You mentioned Ryan Braun for a minute. I have my own thoughts. I happen to think that he's going to retire. Just all the nagging injuries over the last several years have kind of caught up to him, in my opinion. His wife, they had their third child during, I guess it would have been during the season, but it was during the quarantine, the pandemic in the spring. So he's got now three young kids at home. I just think that he's ready to play dad. That's the feeling that I got. Now, when the season began, I didn't necessarily see it that way. What's your gut feeling? Will we see Ryan Braun in a Brewers or maybe someone else's uniform in 2021?
My gut feeling gives less than a 50% chance that we see him back. He only played in 39 of 60 games this year, you know, right around two-thirds of the games. In a normal season, that's going to equate to about 105 games. So, you know, not a great super long season. And that's, again, not even in a 162-game grind would he have even been able to last those 105 this year. Yeah, one of those injuries was a fluke fingernail injury or something. But he did have the back issues, the neck issues at the beginning. The back issue came back at the end. I lean towards the way that season ended. You know, he wasn't even able to stick it out in that playoff game, and that must have meant that he was really hurt to, you know, not try and come back out there for game two. So he's got a lot to think about. Again, this kind of goes back to the COVID situation. If it is still an issue come next year, does that family aspect of his decision start to weigh on him a little bit more? I have to agree with you. I think there's more of a chance of him retiring unless he finds the Fountain of Youth or something like that over this offseason. I find it more likely that he retires than plays on a different team. I think if the Brewers would be able to find a way to bring him back at some sort of price that hopefully would equate to the amount of games he'd be able to play, I find that more likely than him going and playing somewhere else. But of all of that, I think we may have seen the last of him in a Brewer uniform or any uniform.
Maybe the Dodgers. I've, you know, long thought that if he was going to play maybe one last season, it would be if the Dodgers needed a bat. I still think he can produce if he's healthy, but again, maybe this was it for him. That having been said, let's assume just for the sake of this conversation that this is it for Ryan Braun. I definitely think it. You kind of think it as well. What's his legacy when you look back on Ryan Braun's career as a Milwaukee Brewer?
You know, it's obviously we know that there's the PED history in the background, and some fans have forgiven him for that, some fans haven't. There's a question of will his number be retired? I go back and forth whether I think that'll actually happen. I think there's a possibility it happens further down the road when he's even further removed from, you know, the PED memory. Whether he gets the statue, I don't know anything about that. But when it comes down to it, you know, Ryan Braun was the leader of a core that brought playoff baseball back to Milwaukee. 2008, 2011, back to kind of some down years in between. And then end of the decade, we get this now 3-year run. Unprecedented run. First time in franchise history we've made it 3 years in a row, and he was around for all of that. If anything, that's what we can remember. And obviously he's, you know, leading in home runs now for the Brewers, on top of being at the top of or near the top of plenty of categories in team history. But it's the playoffs. It's that Milwaukee fans now have an expectation of good teams in Milwaukee, where, you know, I grew up watching Brewers teams in the 90s. That was definitely not something we thought would ever come or was far, far down the road, and he helped bring it back for us.
No, I was there too. Yeah, it was bad, you know, when you're one of 8,000 fans at freezing County Stadium in mm-hmm. April. And 8,000, that's generous. More like 2,000 or 3,000 during some of those really down years. Lorenzo Cain opted out after a few games this season. In your opinion, how much did the team miss Lo Cain's presence on the field and in the clubhouse?
You know, it was huge. I think Avi Garcia did an admirable job, I'll put it that way.
I thought he was really good in center field, not so much with the bat consistently, but I thought he played a good center field. I agree with you.
Yeah, I think he did, but he's no Lorenzo Cain. I mean, Lorenzo Cain got his gold glove finally last year. There's very few like him. So you were missing that in the field. You're missing him at the top of that order. And, you know, in those first few games, he started to show that he had kind of shaken off that little bit of a slumping 2019 where he was fighting all those nagging injuries. And then he opts out, and the Brewers just never really figured out a solution for the leadoff hitter. And, you know, that may have played into some of the struggles. Had he been around and had he been able to set that table consistently for some of those big hitters like Yelich and Hira, I'm not saying that there's no way they would have gone through slumps, but with him around, you know, how could that have maybe changed the outlook of the offense that finished with a .223 batting average, mind you? But then, like you were saying, just that clubhouse presence, that is a big presence to lose in the dugout and in the clubhouse. That hurt, I think, more than anything in a time where, you know, feelings are tense. You're going on the road in this COVID situation. You're needing something to kind of keep everyone together, especially as you've got hitters slumping. And so that was a big missing aspect of this team.
Matt Carroll joining us from Reviewing the Brew, part of the Fansided Network, also co-host of the Cold Brew podcast alongside David Gasper. Podcasters have to stick together. That's the way I look at it. Matt, as long as we're talking about the offense and the outfield, I've asked you about Ryan Braun. I've asked you about Lorenzo Cain. We talked about Avi Garcia. You mentioned Christian Yelich's name, and I think that's got to be the biggest mystery of what went wrong in 2020. Christian Yelich, who won back-to-back batting titles, could have won back-to-back MVPs, won one of them two seasons ago, came in second to Cody Bellinger last year. This season, he was barely over the Mendoza line. What went, in your opinion, so horrifically wrong for Yelly at the plate? Because there were times he just looked lost up there.
Yeah, he sure did, didn't he? At the beginning of the year, just everything looked completely wrong. He was swinging and missing. He was taking pitches in the zone. He was connecting here and there, but it was just bad. And then he goes on a little bit of a run. Things start to look a little bit normal again. And then he's kind of up and down for the rest of the year, right? A lot of what he did kind of towards the end of the year was almost play a little too tentative. His walk rate was way up, actually, but of course, so was his strikeout rate. He still had high exit velocity, highest on the team, I believe it was.
One of the highest still, in the league, actually.
Yeah, he still ended up with a decent OPS. He tied for the team lead in Fangraphs WAR. So when he actually connected, you know, things went well, but he just, there were times where he got too tentative. And then there were also moments where, surprisingly enough, for a guy like him, the moment almost got too big for him. He batted in the low 100s with runners in scoring position when he was well above 300 last year. So those are the moments when you need your former MVP to come through. And between him and also, you know, players like Keston Hira, it just wasn't happening. And, you know, that's a big part that leads to, you know, a down offensive year. You can say what you will about going and picking up certain offensive players in the offseason and seeing who sticks and barely any of them sticking. But when your MVP isn't coming through, there's just no way.
David Stearns on Tuesday at his season-ending news conference said that at this time they have no coaching changes to make. And I know that Christian Yelich and Andy Haynes go back a long way, but you look at this team's offense, and I know it's easier to just fire the coach, but, and I know that they were working hard. I'm not questioning that, but was Andy Haynes' message just not getting through? Because offensively, this was the worst team in the National League.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's hard to tell exactly what you judge off of this type of season. There were other good hitters who had bad seasons as well, not just hitters on the Brewers. Brewers scored 4.02 runs per game, you know, 27th in the league. Surprisingly enough, third in the NL Central, because both the Reds and Pirates were worse than us. The Cubs,
which
actually,
is hard to imagine, but yes,
I know. Right. The Cubs actually had a worse batting average than the Brewers. Brewers ended up finishing the season in 26th place in MLB, but the Cubs, Pirates, and Reds were all had worse team batting averages than us. So did anyone realize that the Brewers actually finished second in the NL Central in batting average? Not that that's saying much. but that goes
it's
to show
to
that
imagine. That's unfathomable,
right? But that goes to show that there were a lot of weird things that happened offensively this season. So can you put it all on Andy Haynes? You know, there were a couple of those moments where Haynes was able to get with Yelich in the batting cage, and then the next day he'd come out and have one of his actually good games. So you know, I think the potential is there for him to still lead the way. And then add on top of that, one of the things that, you know, forgets to get mentioned every once in a while was the lack of being able to go to certain video during the season, you know, something that hitters would have potentially used previously to, you know, kind of tinker with things mid-game. They didn't have that, so it just, I can't tell how much weight to put on Andy Haynes. I know that's a kind of gut reaction of a lot of fans to say, fire the hitting coach when hitting is poor, but hitting was poor for a lot of teams, so he may end up getting a pass on this. But that said, you know, Stern saying, you know, we're not making any decisions yet isn't saying Haynes' job is safe. So you still never know.
On the flip side, there were some things that did go well for this Brewers team in 2020, notably on the pitching staff. Brandon Woodruff, as you might suspect, was very good. But Corbin Burnes, the leap that he took from 2019 to 2020. Now, granted, it's in a truncated season. But Corbin Burnes finally started to look like the pitcher that the Brewers thought he was going to be when he was that quote-unquote untouchable guy with all of those trades that were contemplated back in 2018 at the deadline.
Yeah, that was amazing to see what Burnes did this year. Really unfortunate that he ended up finishing that one out away from actually being able to qualify for some of the, you know, statistical categories. But we saw what he brought to the team in 2018, and then, you know, we also saw what he brought to the team in 2019. But, you know, he got to go down there, work at that pitching lab, and they were really to get both his mindsets and his mechanics really shaped up for this season. And then we saw what ended up transpiring. It's really nice to see that the Brewers now are starting to have a track record of developing some pitchers. Like you said, you know, we had Brandon Woodruff looked good this season. We had Corbin Burnes, but Devin Williams, you know, we all love to talk about him. Pitching Ninja loves to talk about him and that best changeup in the league. Justin Topo was able to get called up and kind of come out of nowhere after being an indie ball guy who got to come into the Brewers minor league system and, you know, get developed a little bit. The Brewers are finding their way to get some good pitching up here, and that, if you know, we were able to take anything from this season, that's definitely a positive.
Final thing on the team, you mentioned Devin Williams. Is he, if you're Craig Counsell, is he your closer next year? I mean, if Josh Hader's still on the roster, he's obviously going to be your ninth inning guy, but that's the question. Who's going to be the closer, in your opinion, next season, Hader or Williams?
It definitely seems like now would be the time. I mean, last year also kind of seemed like now would be the time, but it seems like now would be the time to trade Hader while his value is still up there, right? And because of the fact that you have a pretty easy replacement at closer in Devin Williams. A bullpen is a position of depth for the Brewers. Outside of Williams and Hader, you had a guy like Eric Yardley, who had a sub-2 ERA. He was solid. Not necessarily saying he'd be a setup guy going into next year, but he would absolutely be looked to hold down a bullpen spot. You'd have Corey Knebel, another year removed from Tommy John surgery. You'd have these young guys like Topa and Rasmussen, who definitely flashed before his last couple kind of disappointing outings. And then that's on top of guys like, you know, Suter and potentially Claudio coming back. That's a good bullpen to rely on. So you have Hader while his value is still up there. And like we were actually talking on our podcast about a little bit, Hader has become a little bit more of a complete pitcher now. He's going to that slider a little bit more. He was toying with that changeup in the offseason, which he didn't end up using a whole ton during the season, but he's got that he's kind of working on. That could be a little bit more tantalizing for those potential suitors. I still think, and I think a lot of people think, that it won't be Stearns going out to other teams to shop Hader. He's more probably going to be taking the calls. But now would be the time to do it, potentially get a bat back, potentially get some prospects that you could, you know, spin around for a bat. Stearns likes to make moves in the offseason, and this is the one obvious move to make when you don't have a lot of prospects to deal and there's not really a lot of other obvious names in the majors with which to deal from either.
He is Matt Carroll from Reviewing the Brew for the Fansided Network. You mentioned your podcast, the Cold Brew Podcast. How many episodes do you do about that? Where can we find it? And tell us about it.
So you can find it on pretty much any of your streaming services. We record weekly, usually in the middle of the week. We try to have a guest on every week. We were able to break out with Robert Murray, National MLB Insider, in the first one. We've kind of had some various guests since then. But we will be rolling on into the postseason as well, just kind of analyzing any moves as they come and trying to take our best shot at guessing what's going to happen.
You and me both.
Yeah.
Along with David Gasper, of course. He is Matt Carroll. Again, find him, the Cold Brew Podcast, midweek, wherever you find your podcast, maybe where you find this podcast as well. Matt, I appreciate the time so much. We'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. There he goes, Matt Carroll. Find his outstanding work again at Reviewing the Brew. That's part of the Fansided Network. That'll about do it for this edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. A couple of happy birthdays that I'd like to get out there. And I don't know when you'll be listening to this. This is the weekend edition of the program. But if you're listening on Saturday, you can send a happy birthday to Brett Favre, turns 51 years old on October 10th. So happy birthday to the gunslinger. Also, if you're listening on Friday, today is the 80th, or would have been the 80th birthday of the great John Lennon, one of the greatest songwriters of all time. I think that there's a couple of parallels that you can draw between Brett Favre and John Lennon, believe it or not. Stay with me on this. At their peak of popularity, they were both so enigmatic. Brett Favre was not only the face of the Green Bay Packers, Brett Favre was the face of the state of Wisconsin for the 16 years that he played for the Packers. Likewise, John Lennon was one of the most popular and famous people in the world throughout the second half of his lifetime, really from the age of his very early 20s when the Beatles hit, you know, Beatlemania, when they had, you know, the British invasion, when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, right up until his death. And in the aftermath of his death, when he was murdered in December of 1980 outside of his apartment building, the Dakota, in New York City, he was, again, enigmatic. He was someone who was instantly recognizable. And the other parallels is that the two of them, Favre and Lennon, found peace later in their lives, because when they were at the height of their popularity, they weren't necessarily very good people. By his own admission, Brett Favre wasn't a very good husband to Deanna Favre. Since his retirement, he's found peace, and now they're just an old married couple with their grandkids down in Mississippi. For John Lennon, never got to see any of his grandkids. He wasn't old enough to see either Sean or Julian have any of their kids. But John Lennon wasn't a very good father to Julian Lennon, by John's own admission. John's first wife, Cynthia, he wasn't a very good husband to her either. But as he got older, in his 30s, after the breakup of the Beatles, as his marriage to Yoko Ono bore out Sean Lennon, quite literally, he became a better person, a more peaceful person. And I'm glad for him that he found that later on in life. And I know that Yoko Ono gets a lot of bad publicity for the perception that she broke up the Beatles. And Paul McCartney has said on numerous occasions that Yoko Ono didn't break up the Beatles. It was Paul that wanted to move on and do other things. You look at, and he did. I mean, Paul McCartney is still recording, for crying out loud. My wife and I went to go see Paul McCartney in concert in Las Vegas a year ago. He played for 3 hours, played some of his newer stuff, played some great Wings classics, but also went back into the Beatles catalog and played some of the songs that he wrote for the Beatles. And that's, I guess, one of the misnomers of the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership. It wasn't necessarily that they co-wrote songs. It was Paul wrote some songs and John wrote some other songs. I mean, some of the great John Lennon songs, he wrote Strawberry Fields Forever. He wrote Help, for example. My favorite Beatles song is In My Life, one of the prettiest, most perfect songs you'll ever come across. And John Lennon wrote that song. He wrote Tomorrow Never Knows. He wrote Rain, for example. Norwegian Wood, I Am the Walrus. These are all John Lennon songs that he wrote, and he was so prolific as a writer, as was McCartney, and that was part of their popularity. So happy birthday to John Lennon, if he were still with us, but he's been gone longer, or almost now, and just in a few short weeks, they'll cross that more than halfway point if he's been gone longer than he was with us, which is tragic in its own right. Speaking of which, Eddie Van Halen, maybe the greatest rock guitarist of all time, certainly in the top five. And when you're talking about guys that have picked up the guitar, and there have been maybe a billion people over the course of human existence that have picked up a guitar and strummed it, when you're talking about that many people, it's just personal preference, who you like better as a guitarist. But Eddie Van Halen's name is always in that group. And when 1984 came out, I was 11 years old, and that was right at that peak of when you're really starting to get into music as a kid. And I was just revolutionary. And I could never pick up the guitar and do what Eddie Van Halen did, but you could just sit there and just marvel at it. And one of the things about Eddie Van Halen that he maybe got a bad rap for is because, you know, that's what rock music was in the 70s and 80s. It was so much excess. It was drugs flying all over the place. And when he hooked up with Valerie Bertinelli, a young, very popular actress on One Day at a Time at the time, there was a lot of people who said, wow, this is bad for Valerie's career. This will be bad for, I mean, they were married for more than 20 years and they were still close. She was with him along with Eddie's wife of the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and Eddie's son with Valerie, who's now the bassist for Van Halen, or has been the bassist for Van Halen, Wolfgang Van Halen. They were all together with him when Eddie died earlier this week. And one of the things that I didn't realize about, and maybe I should have, about Wolfgang Van Halen is how unbelievable of a guitarist he was. We know about Eddie. Wolf was the bassist for Van Halen. But this was posted, and you know, I think many of us have done a deep dive on Eddie Van Halen, maybe some of the posts that he made on social media over the last couple of years of his life. And one of the things that you really found out about Eddie Van Halen is how much he and his son just had this incredible bond. So for all maybe the wild stories about Van Halen and Eddie Van Halen being this rock star, he was a family man at the end of the day. Even though his marriage to Valerie Bertinelli didn't work out at the end, they were friends at the end, which I think is important for their son, Wolfgang. But this is not Eddie, but this was Wolfgang Van Halen from, I think, 3 years ago. Check the date on it. September 9th, 2017, posted on Wolf Van Halen and Eddie Van Halen, then retweeted it. This is Wolf playing Eruption, the guitar riff from Eruption, 40 years ago to the date that it was recorded. Now, that again, that was 3 years ago. But this is the son, not the father, but this is the son. And this is what I'll leave you with here on the Doug Russell Podcast. Have a great weekend. We will talk to you on Monday.